Well, thank you very much for those devotions. That was a good introduction to our talk this morning. Our brother said that we have not faced a drought in recent memory. And the people we're going to be talking about in this lesson this morning had not faced a drought in their recent memory either. The Mexican War, before the Civil War, there was no drought. It did not prepare Mennonites for the Civil War. The War of 1812, there was no drought. Mennonites had suffered in the American Revolution, but by the time of the Civil War, that was, as Abraham Lincoln said, 87 years ago. And Mennonites had not published anything about non-resistance since the time of the American Revolution and the colonial age. And so we have no way of knowing how often non-resistance was preached. I'm sure it was preached. I'm sure it was emphasized, but we have no idea or no way of knowing exactly how strongly it was taught before the Civil War. And so Mennonites found themselves in a situation of being, in some ways, unprepared. The Civil War redefined America in many ways. It redefined the relationship of the black and white races, so-called races. It redefined the relationship of the states to each other and to the federal government. It redefined the powers of the presidency. It redefined the sections of the nation, the South, the North, and the West, in their relationships to each other. Just as Jesus Christ divided history between B.C. and A.D., so the Civil War divides American history between antebellum and post-Civil War eras. And in many important ways, the Civil War also shaped and redefined American Anabaptists. Now I'm going to recommend a couple of books because we are only going to be able to scratch the surface this morning of everything that could be said about the Mennonite experience in the Civil War. This book, Mennonites, Amish, and the American Civil War by James Lehman and Stephen Nolte, is the best treatment of Anabaptists in the Civil War. And definitely recommended if you're interested in learning more. And another book I'll recommend is Christianity and War by John M. Brenneman. We're going to be talking about this book a lot more, or some more later in the lesson. This was written during the Civil War and was a tract that John M. Brenneman, who was bishop in Ohio, wrote to explain non-resistance to outsiders. The Civil War has its roots in slavery. African slavery began in the American colonies in the 1600s, and it was protected by the American Constitution. Northern states, like Pennsylvania, eventually abolished slavery, but the Southern economy and society came to depend on the institution of slavery, especially with cotton farming, which was very labor-intensive. And there came to be a delicate balance of political power between slave and free states. Whenever there was a new state added, there was great controversy over whether it would be a free state or a slave state, because there was just this delicate balance of power in Congress and in the Electoral College between the two kinds of states. Now, of course, people who were enslaved tried to get out of that situation, and so we have the beginnings of the Underground Railroad, as it was known, where people who are held in bondage would try to escape, and then with the help of often white collaborators in the North along the route would try to help them escape to freedom in northern states or in Canada. Now, southern slaveholders, of course, were furious at this, and the collaboration of northern abolitionists with the fugitives trying to help them to escape. In the southern mindset, slaves were not human beings with inherent rights, but they were property, the same as a horse or a cow. Now, as part of this delicate balance of power, in 1850, the Missouri Compromise was passed. And part of the Missouri Compromise was the Fugitive Slave Act. Now, the Fugitive Slave Act was an enforcement of a clause in the Constitution which protected the rights of slave owners to their fugitive slaves. But the Fugitive Slave Act was a terribly draconian law. It said that escaped slaves could be arrested in free states and brought back to slavery, but anyone aiding escaped slaves was subject to fines of up to $1,000, a tremendous amount of money in 1850, and 6 months in prison, plus restitution of $1,000 per slave helped to the slave owner. So this was a draconian legislation aimed at stamping out white northern collaboration with the Underground Railroad. Now, what is potentially even worse is that the Fugitive Slave Act became cover for kidnapping of free black people, because the North had a population, especially in cities, big cities like Boston, had a population of black people who were born free, who had never been enslaved, and so Southern slave catchers would actually kidnap free black people to take them back into slavery, that they had never been in slavery, so not even back. When a slave catcher would apprehend a black person, supposedly a slave, he would have to bring the accused person to a commissioner, federally appointed commissioner, who would hear the case and rule on the case. Now, the commissioner, according to the Fugitive Slave Act, was paid $10 if he ruled that the defendant belonged to the white claimant, and only $5 if he ruled the defendant was free. So the system was, it was bald-faced rigged. Now, the slaveholding South was wanting to expand its power in Congress, in the Electoral College, its political power, at the cost of the free North. And so there was even calls for conquest of non-American territory to add it as slave states. And so, for instance, U.S. Senator from Mississippi, Albert Gallatin Brown, said this on the floor of Congress in 1858. "I want Cuba and one or two other Mexican states, and I want them all for the same reason, for the planting and spreading of slavery. I would spread the blessings of slavery, like the religion of our divine master, to the uttermost ends of the earth. And rebellious and wicked as the Yankees have been, I would even extend it to them. I would not force it upon them, as I would not force religion upon them, but I would preach it to them, as I would preach the gospel." Now, the controversy over slavery became so hot that violence would even break out on the floors of Congress itself. And so, for example, in 1858, after giving a fiery anti-slavery speech, Senator Charles Sumner was beaten with a cane severely by a Southern representative. Grateful Southerners mailed canes to the representative, inscribed with the phrase, "Hit him again." Now, there was violence on both sides. For instance, many people are aware of the story of John Brown, who was a fierce abolitionist. He lived in Ohio for a while and then moved to Kansas when Kansas was being admitted into the Union. And there was fierce competition between slaveholders and free soilers in Kansas, which one would outnumber the other and be able to vote on a pro-slavery or an anti-slavery constitution that admit Kansas as a slave or free state. And John Brown murdered slaveholders in cold blood in Kansas as part of this struggle. Now, his favorite verse was, "Without the shedding of blood is no remission of sins." And he became convinced that only by shedding blood could the sin of slavery be purged from America. And so with some of his sons and some of his closest associates, he stormed the federal arsenal in what is now West Virginia, Harper's Ferry, Virginia. And the U.S. Marines, led by Robert E. Lee and Jeb Stuart, broke in, wounded, and apprehended John Brown. And he waited behind that jail door that you see in that photograph, which is now on display in the Gettysburg Museum. He waited behind that jail door for his execution by hanging. Northern states hailed him as a martyr for liberty, and Southern states viewed him as a terrorist. Now, all of this tension between the states came to a head in the election of 1860, when four men vied for the presidency. The Republican Party nominated Abraham Lincoln, who was a moderate on slavery, and the The National Union Party, which was a third party, nominated John Bell. And then the Democratic Party split into two, into northern and southern factions. The southern factions nominated John Breckinridge, and the northerners nominated Stephen Douglas. And you see the map there. That's the electoral map. Abraham Lincoln carried a solid north, Breckinridge carried a solid south, and Douglas and Bell split the border states, resulting in a victory for Abraham Lincoln and the Republican Party. Now, the Southerners had been threatened. Southerners had threatened secession since the days of Andrew Jackson, the seventh president, and they had done it so often that it's sort of like the boy who cried wolf. Northerners stopped taking them seriously, that they would actually try to secede from the country. But what should have given everyone pause was the split in the Democratic Party, that the Democrat Party could not even nominate a single person for president, and that the Southerners were this serious about secession this time that they would actually do it. From the Southern perspective, they saw that this delicate balance of power had now shifted in the North's favor. The North could elect a president on its own votes against the united votes of the South. And so, before Lincoln's inauguration, the states in the deep red all seceded and proclaimed themselves to be a new country, the Confederate States of America. After Lincoln's inauguration, the states in the light red seceded as well to make up the Confederate States. And then, of course, Virginia, as you can see, Virginia looks different then than it does now. West Virginia stayed with the Union and ended up becoming its own state during the Civil War. The Confederate States appointed their own president, Jefferson Davis, and soon after that, the war began at Fort Sumter when Confederates fired on the federal fortifications there. Now, the vice president of the Confederacy, Alexander Stevens, soon before the beginning of the war, gave what is called the Cornerstone Speech, in which he explained the vision of the Confederate States. Now, to understand this quote, you must realize that he's talking about the founders of the United States, that they had seen slavery as a necessary evil. They had allowed for it in the Constitution, but it was an evil to be contained. And he says, "Our new government, the Confederate government, is founded upon exactly the opposite idea. Its foundations are laid, its cornerstone rests upon the great truth that the Negro is not equal to the white man, that slavery, subordination to the superior race, is his natural and normal condition. This, our new government, is the first in the history of the world based upon this great physical, philosophical, and moral truth. This stone, which was rejected by the first builders, is become the chief of the corner, the real cornerstone in our new edifice. I care not who or how many they may be against us, when we stand upon the eternal principles of truth, if we are true to ourselves and the principles for which we contend, we are obliged to and must triumph." Now, in response to this baldly and reprehensibly white supremacist speech, Lincoln said this in a letter to Alexander Stevens: "You think slavery is right and ought to be extended, while we think it is wrong and ought to be restricted. That, I suppose, is the rub. It certainly is the only substantial difference between us." During the Civil War, Charles Sumner, yes, the same man who was almost beaten to death on the Senate floor, gave a speech called "The Barbarism of Slavery," in which he says, "Therefore, there are two apparent rudiments to this war. One is slavery, and the other is state rights. But the latter is only a cover for the former. If slavery were out of the way, there would be no trouble from state rights. The war, then, is for slavery and nothing else. It is an insane attempt to vindicate by arms the lordship which has already been asserted in debate. With madcap audacity, it seeks to install this barbarism as the truest civilization." Now, with that foundation of the political context set, what was the Anabaptist response or the Anabaptist participation in this discussion over slavery? Well, Anabaptists hold a good record on slavery. In fact, a practically spotless record on slavery in American history. Peter Burkholder, a Virginia Mennonite author, wrote, "And moreover, as all are free in Christ, they must take no part in slaveholding or in trafficking with them in any wise." And Virginia Conference, which was the only Anabaptist community, Virginia and the Washington County Mennonites were both in slave states. Maryland was a slave state as well. And so Virginia Conference had apparently a understanding from its very beginnings that slaveholding and the use of slave labor was not allowed among its members. In fact, in April 1864, during the war, this was on the official minutes of Virginia Conference. "Inasmuch as it is against our creed and discipline to own or traffic in slaves, so it is also forbidden for a brother to hire a slave unless such slave be entitled to receive the pay for such labor by the consent of his owner. But where neighbors exchange labor, the labor of slaves may be received." Now, Mennonites also participated in the Underground Railroad. For instance, Lancaster Conference Minister Peter Nisley, who is photographed there, participated in the Underground Railroad by giving shelter to fugitive slaves. Other Lancaster County Mennonites did as well. Now, Abraham Lincoln said this, writing to a Quaker woman. He said, "Your people, the Friends, or the Quakers, have had and are having a very great trial. On principle and faith, opposed to both war and oppression, they can only practically oppose oppression by war. In this hard dilemma, some have chosen one horn and some the other." And that could be said of Mennonites as well. Mennonites opposed both war and oppression. But while Lincoln took this ironic view of the dilemma of non-resistant people, Stephen Douglas spoke for many others when he said, "There are only two sides to the question. Every man must be for the United States or against it. There can be no neutrals in this war, only patriots or traitors." And so Anabaptists were stuck in that middle ground between patriots and traitors. Now here's a map of where Anabaptists lived in 1860 at the beginning of the war. And there were really three different kinds of Anabaptist experience. You had the experience of Anabaptists living in eastern Pennsylvania, in places like Lancaster County. And you had the experience of people scattered across the Midwest through Ohio, Indiana, Illinois, Michigan, and into Missouri and Iowa. And then you had in Rockingham and Augusta counties, you had one community that was living in what became the Confederacy. That's the only place where Mennonites lived in the Confederacy. There were some Dunkers, or what we would today call German Baptists, living in Tennessee as well. And there were Quakers in North Carolina. Now, in response, some Mennonite young men did enlist, especially unbaptized young men tempted by war propaganda. For instance, Aaron Stauffer, the son of Jacob Stauffer, who after whom the Stauffer Mennonites, Old Order Mennonites, are named. Even some older men enlisted. For example, an Amish man by the name of Christian Hostetler. And when he came back after the war, apparently unrepentant, his bishop refused him communion, so he moved to another Amish community where he would be served communion. But Anabaptists in the North did not face much pressure until 1862, when the militia drafts began. On June 17th of 1862, a militia bill was passed that allowed the president to call state militias into federal service for 9 months. Now, the militia service, which would be similar to the National Guard today, was, before the Civil War, was a state-run military operation that could be used within the borders of a particular state for state defense. So they were not supposed to be taken outside the boundaries of their own state. But this militia bill allowed the president to call state militias into federal service and thus send them wherever they were needed for up to 9 months. Of course, when the war started, both sides thought it was going to be a very short war, but as 1861 drug into 1862, it became obvious that this was going to be a protracted conflict, and a whole lot of people were going to be needed. So the War Department asked for 300,000 nine-month men from the state militias, and conscription began. Now, the War Department offered a $25 forward in advance against pay to volunteers to induce men to volunteer for the state militias and be sent on federal service. And Mennonites pled for exemption from these drafts. John H. Oberholzer, founder of the General Conference Mennonite Church, said this: "We saw robust men shed tears and women begin to weep together when these drafts began. People ran to the draft officials hoping that, quote, the destroying angel had passed them by." Now, some Mennonites felt that giving a petition to President Lincoln himself would help to get them exemption from these drafts. And they asked John M. Brenneman, a bishop in Elida, Ohio, in western Ohio, to please write the petition for them. And he thought that this was not a good idea. He didn't think it was going to work. He said, "What is the president? He is a broken reed, and we should plead for exemption to the God of heaven, and that would do better. But nevertheless, he wrote a draft, which I'll read a little bit of here. "We would herewith inform the president that there is a people scattered and living mostly in the northern parts of the United States, Pennsylvania, Virginia, Ohio, Indiana, and some few in Illinois and Iowa, called Mennonites, who are greatly distressed at the present time on account of the war, as it is against their confession of faith and also against their conscience to take up arms therewith to destroy human life. We therefore beseech our good president to favor us in this respect and not allow us to be forced or compelled to take up arms against our consciences, as we would thereby have to renounce our faith and break our promise to God, who alone has power over our consciences. But we do by no means expect or ask to be entirely screened from the burden of the war, but we pray and beg for God's sake that the liberty may be granted us to pay a fine when drafted instead of taking up arms. We would not prescribe to the president how to deal with us, but we humbly pray and beseech him that upon some terms or other we may be allowed our religious liberty. We hope and pray that the president will be so kind as to issue immediate orders to the several governors of those states wherein the Mennonites reside, instructing the governors to be favorably inclined to us poor creatures of the dust, especially to the governor of Ohio, as the Mennonites in Ohio seem to be in the most danger." Now, that petition, as far as we know, was never completed or sent to Abraham Lincoln. But nevertheless, Mennonites had to respond to the draft. And some responded by hiring substitutes, which sounds odd to us today, although it was a long-standing European and American custom. If you were impressed for service into military service and did not want to go for whatever reason, perhaps you were a rich person, didn't want to go, perhaps you had family that depended on you, whatever it was, you could hire someone else who was not drafted or impressed into service, or maybe was ineligible in the Civil War. Some immigrants, recent immigrants, were not eligible or subject to the draft, but maybe they would be fine going, taking a payment for substitution and would go. You could pay a substitute to go in your place. Now, many Mennonites did do this, and some of them felt guilty afterwards, feeling that paying someone directly to go do something that you yourself are conscientiously opposed to doing and felt would be sin was wrong. Now, the Amish generally avoided substitution. Some Amish did hire substitutes, but they took a stricter line on that. It did not generally hire substitutes. And exemption for a price did come. Pennsylvania made a system of giving certificates of exemption for which a person would pay and be released from the draft. Also, Ohio and Indiana had similar setups. Now, this was annoying to Anabaptists' neighbors. Steve Nolte and James Lehman write in their book, "Already in September, the Doylestown Democrat newspaper had unloosed biting sarcasm at Mennonites' rush to obtain certificates of exemption from the draft. The lame leaped as if they had been restored. The blind saw the door open half a mile distant," the editor complained, and the deaf who couldn't hear a cannon at their elbow immediately heard the whisper when the draft officials were ready. Their behavior was embarrassing in the extreme. So what did they end up paying for exemption from these militia drafts? Well, the Pennsylvania legislature never got around to setting the fee, so Pennsylvania Mennonites got off for free. In Ohio, Mennonites had to pay a $200 fee, and the governor wanted to use the money to hire substitutes and give aid to wounded soldiers. Indiana also set the fee at $200, but they were not able to set up the infrastructure for collecting the fee. There was a whole bunch of problems, and eventually the few who paid actually ended up getting their money refunded, and so they also got exempt for free. Now, it's in spite of this first brush with the draft, Mennonites, Anabaptists living in the North were not directly touched by the war until towards the end of 1862, when the war came north and with the Antietam campaign. Robert E. Lee led his army north, hoping to win a decisive victory on northern soil and win foreign recognition from the British and French for the Confederate states, who he hoped would throw their weight in behind the Confederate cause and force the federal government to the negotiating table. The two armies clashed at the Battle of Antietam, which was fought on land mostly owned by Dunkards or German Baptists. Now, that famous photograph, which you see there, the building in the background, which is riddled with cannon holes, is a Dunker meeting house. Now, a week later, on October 10th, Confederate cavalry commander Jeb Stuart raided all the way into Pennsylvania as far as Chambersburg and stole 2,000 horses, including some from 22 Mennonite farms. So Anabaptists tasted the bitter realities of war during this campaign. And the Dunkard meeting house there at Antietam was used as a field hospital for wounded soldiers. Now, as a result of the Union victory, ambiguous as it was, but nevertheless, Lee did retreat. So as a result of the Union victory at Antietam, Abraham Lincoln issued the Emancipation Proclamation, proclaiming that as of January 1st, 1863, all people held in slavery in territories or states still under rebellion would be forever free. Now, some people have said that Abraham Lincoln didn't actually free any slaves directly with this proclamation. That's not really true, because now every fugitive who would come into the lines of the Union Army would be unqualifiably free, and the Union Army could free any slaves that it found in those territories that were under rebellion as of January 1st, 1863. Now, that proclamation, while it was tremendously exciting to abolitionists, it did not necessarily translate directly into increased recruitment or battlefield success. And so in 1863, for the first time in United States history, there was a federal draft. The drafts in 1862 were state militia drafts. This time, the federal government itself would directly call up people into the direct service of the armies fighting the Civil War. The draft offered commutation for anyone for any reason for $300 and allowed the hiring of substitutes. Now, $300 doesn't sound like a tremendous amount of money today, but remember, this is 1860s dollars. This was a huge amount of money. But still, for any reason, a person could pay $300 and get off of the draft. Now, though, it only freed you from one round of the draft. You could, if there was another draft, be called up again and have to pay $300 again. Now, in 1863, in the summer, the war came north again with the Gettysburg Campaign. General Robert E. Lee again invaded the North, hoping to win a decisive victory on northern soil and force the federal government to the bargaining table to grant freedom or secession to the southern states. Lee ordered his soldiers to abstain from looting, but to pay for what they took in Confederate money, which, of course, was worthless in the North and was actually, because of inflation, worthless in the South as well. Destruction and thieving was actually what prevailed. Lee's soldiers destroyed things, stole things, took as many, apprehended as many black people as they could to drag them back into slavery in the South without regard to whether they were born free or not. One Dunker man was killed when he did not hand over cash to the invading Confederates. One Mennonite family was robbed at gunpoint, and soldiers threatened to shoot the father, but they left when he closed his eyes and prayed. So Mennonites were definitely targets of, not intentional targets because they were Mennonite, but they were targets of some of this destruction and thievery. And in this whole situation, Mennonites never used force to prevent the seizure of their goods. However, a few were less than truthful. For instance, one Mennonite father had had his sons take the wheels off of one of his wagons and hide them, and then told the invading soldiers he had no idea where the wheels had gone, so they couldn't steal his wagon. Now, Lee wanted to get to Harrisburg, to the capital of Pennsylvania, which would have required crossing the Susquehanna River. At the time, which was spanned by the Columbia-Wrightsville Bridge, and it was a huge transportation artery. It had railroad crossing, railroad tracks across it, pedestrian wagons, everything. It was a very important piece of infrastructure. But some northern local Pennsylvania militia defended it until they couldn't hold out against the Confederate Army anymore, and they retreated across the bridge and burned it as they went. So that saved Harrisburg and further on Lancaster County from Confederate invasion. So Lee turned back around, and the two armies ended up clashing at Gettysburg. The third day of Gettysburg, just before Pickett's charge, there was the largest artillery cannonade that has ever been seen, even to this day, in the Western Hemisphere. It was so loud that Peter Nisley, 35 miles away, could hear the cannonading of the third day of battle. Now, about this time, a young man by the name of John F. Funk, who had been raised in the Franconia area, but had gone to Chicago to seek his fortune, he had become a Mennonite. He was raised a Mennonite and had sort of walked away from his heritage, gone to Chicago to seek his fortune, but he ended up thoroughly converted and joining the Mennonite church. And he wrote the first Mennonite defense of non-resistance published during the Civil War, a booklet called Warfare, Its Evils, Our Duty. In this short pamphlet, he focused on the horrific nature of war and contrasted it with the meek and lowly Jesus and how those two do not go together. And a follower of the meek and lowly Jesus cannot possibly participate in the gruesome destruction of war. He says, "Thus, for instance, rises a great military hero. He comes to us with garments red with human gore. He has made himself the greatest murderer of the age, the most extensive robber in all the land. At his command, hundreds and thousands of precious lives have been laid cold in death. In his victorious train follows the widow's wail, the orphan's cry, blasted hopes and blighted prospects. And when he is gone, there remain the ashes and the dust of burned and ruined cities, desolated homes, devastated fields, the mourning hearts throughout the land, weeping in bitter agony for the loved ones lost in the bloody strife. But we say, a great man, a mighty conqueror. He has performed great and noble deeds. He has accomplished mighty ends. He deserves our honor, our praise, our homage. And freely we bestow it and bow before him with a warmer devotion than we bow before the throne of the ruler of the universe." Now, encouraged by John F. Funk and his example, the older John M. Brenneman then wrote his treatise on non-resistance titled Christianity and War. It is an excellent book. I highly recommend it. It is, in my opinion, the best short work on non-resistance that is out there. Now, Brenneman took this approach to non-resistance. He's trying to explain it, of course, to Mennonites, but also to non-Mennonites so that they could understand why Mennonites did not go to war. And he focuses on what is the definition of a true Christian. And he says a true Christian is one who follows the example of Christ, one who obeys the commands of Christ, and one who is filled with the Spirit of Christ. So having established that definition, he then asks, can a true Christian, one who possesses these three characteristics, can a true Christian participate in war? And he uses it kind of as a three-point test. And he concludes that a true Christian cannot participate in war. He situates non-resistance in a broader context, a broader view of what true Christianity is, rather than looking at it as kind of an isolated doctrine that you prove or disprove by pulling out proof texts from the Bible. Rather, he takes this broader view of the whole biblical picture of what it means to be a Christian. Now, the next year, in 1864, another book on non-resistance appeared called Non-Resistance Asserted by the Reformed Mennonite author Daniel Musser. Reformed Mennonites were a highly sectarian Mennonite splinter group that had broken off of Lancaster Conference some years before. They believed they were the only true church. They do still exist today, but they're a very small group. I think there's about 300 of them. But they took a much stronger stance on separation from the political world than the old Mennonite church or the mainstream Mennonites did in the Civil War. And they strongly taught against voting and political participation. The book Non-Resistance Asserted emphasizes separation between the two kingdoms. And he defines the difference between the two kingdoms is that the kingdom of darkness is filled with the natural man who is selfish, and it is that selfishness that causes war. The Christian, however, part of the kingdom of Christ, the kingdom of God, is filled with the divine nature, which sheds the love of God abroad in his heart and destroys self-love or self-interest or selfishness. And thus, it is by definition impossible for one who is in that kingdom of Christ, who is filled with the love of God and is unselfish, to participate in the fruit of selfishness or carnal warfare. Now, this book actually had an impact on mainstream Mennonites, even though it came from this other group. It had an impact on mainstream Mennonites because of its strong apologetic or strong polemic against Mennonite voting, which mainstream Mennonites at the time, especially in eastern Pennsylvania, did not have a problem with voting. In fact, there was a lot of political participation at the time of the Civil War. And Daniel Musser and the Reformed Mennonites saw that as very inconsistent. And John M. Brenneman read Non-Resistance Asserted and found it to be a very persuasive argument. And so when he revised Christianity in War after the Civil War was over, he included a very strong polemic against voting. Now, he already had conviction against voting before reading Non-Resistance Asserted, but it did help to sharpen his argument. And so, in a way, this booklet did help to move mainstream Mennonites toward opposition to voting and political participation. That's a story that is fascinating in itself, and we're not going to be able to get into all the details of that. But that is one way in which the Civil War experience significantly shaped who we are today as a people. Now, the draft began about the time of the Battle of Gettysburg, or just after, and citizens and those who are applying for citizenship, recent immigrants, between 20 and 45 male citizens, were enrolled in draft lists. This is how this worked. They would all be enrolled in these draft lists, and then the president would have the authority to call for troops. He would say, I need 300,000 more troops. And then all the different districts would be assigned a quota. If we need a total of 300,000, then your district needs to raise, let's say, 15,000 troops. And then those quotas could be filled by volunteers. The districts would put out a call for volunteers. Now, let's say you raise 10,000 troops by volunteers. That means the district is going to have a draft to raise 5,000 more men to fill their quota. Now, how did the draft work? Well, there was great opposition to it. And in fact, there was, in Holmes County, Ohio, there were draft riots. And some of the rioters got together at a place called Fort Fizzle because it kind of fizzled out when it encountered resistance from federal enforcement. And in New York City, there was a lot of draft riots. And so troops fresh from Gettysburg had to go to New York City to put down these draft riots that were fueled by kind of this conspiracy theory that then as now, big cities were more Democrat than Republican. And so there was kind of this conspiracy theory that Democrat districts were being more heavily drafted so that Democrats would go off to war and be killed, and then, you know, Republicans would have more power in Congress. Kind of a conspiracy theory that wasn't true. Of course, Democrat big cities had higher populations, so of course they're going to be drafted, have to raise more troops in a draft. But in any case, these didn't have anything to do with non-resistance. This was violent opposition to a draft, which, I will remind you, this was the first time a draft had ever been done in American history, a federal draft, and so it was kind of felt like government overreach. So how did the draft work? What were the options? When a person was drafted, a person could fail to report. He could end up being sent home because quotas had already been filled by the time he reported. He could be exempted because he had either disability or was sole means of support for, let's say, a widowed mother or something. He could hire a substitute, pay the commutation fee, or last and least likely, report for duty. Now, if you hired a substitute, you were exempt for the rest of the war. If you paid commutation, you were exempt only for the current draft, which that's why hiring a substitute was tempting to Mennonites. Now, here are the numbers. 20% of drafted people, this is not just Mennonites, but everybody, failed to report. 12.5% were sent home. 40% were exempt. 9.5% hired substitutes. 11% paid the commutation fee, and only 6% of people drafted actually were inducted into the army. 776,000 people were drafted over the course of the war, and only 46,000 of them actually got put into the army. And historian James McPherson explains that this was a, quote, clumsy carrot and stick device to stimulate volunteering. Since a draft was so distasteful to Americans, it would motivate people to volunteer instead of let a draft come off in your district. Compulsory service, he writes, was contrary to the country's values and traditions. With such a low success rate of actually getting people into the ranks, Congress abolished the commutation option in July 1864 for everyone except the conscientiously opposed. So Mennonites were still allowed to pay the commutation fee, although nobody else was, or Anabaptists or non-resistant people. But Mennonites also contributed to bounty funds, which was a locally run thing that you could donate to the bounty fund, and the bounty fund would offer bounties to people who volunteered. So we don't want a draft to come off in this district, so let's make a bounty to volunteers. Let's say we give every volunteer a $100 for volunteering up front. That's not part of his pay from the government. That's our bounty for volunteering. And so Mennonites ended up donating to these bounty funds, and the logic was this. It was basically, if there's a draft, I might get drafted, my son might get drafted, and then, you know, we have to pay a commutation fee or hire a substitute. So it's much better if enough people volunteer. And the more money is in the bounty fund, the bigger bounty that the district can offer, and the less likely that a draft will actually happen. And so the less likely one of us will end up drafted. But some Mennonites saw that as a compromise, similar to hiring substitutes. It was paying other people to do something that you feel is sinful. John M. Brenneman was particularly disturbed by this and wrote to Peter Nisley in November of 1864, "The draft with us once more passed off, and two townships in which most of our brethren reside were heavily drafted, and thanks be to God, every brother came off clear. In another township, one brother was drafted, but the township afterwards was made clear by bounty money so that the brother came clear. But this is what I cannot understand. How it can be right and consistent with our profession for brethren voluntarily to pay bounty money to hire soldiers to go and kill people. It seems to me that the professors of non-resistant Christianity are sifted, and that but few are found left as pure wheat." Daniel Musser, also in Non-Resistance Asserted, wrote strongly against the practice of donating to bounty funds. Now, Mennonites, though, in the Civil War, were not just concerned about escaping from the draft, but also gave aid to soldiers' families. Many of them, some and anyway, served in local relief committees or donated to aid committees, which would have provided food, blankets, and aid to wounded soldiers and their families or to soldiers' widows. Mennonites also donated items such as food or blankets. One newspaper wrote about Mennonites. They said, saying, upon Mennonites, upon whom so much unreasonable abuse has been visited, now show themselves more patriotic than the stay-at-home sensation mongers who revile them. So Mennonites did were concerned to make a positive contribution in ways that they conscientiously could in this conflict. Now, one of the most significant things long-term that affected the Mennonites that came out of the Civil War was the founding of the Herald of Truth newspaper by John F. Funk in 1864. Encouraged and supported by John M. Brenneman and Peter Nisley, Funk began the first old Mennonite newspaper in English, and also he published a German version, emphasizing non-resistance, seeing a need for teaching to emphasize and strengthen conviction for non-resistance, and also eventually for ending Mennonite participation in politics by voting. John F. Funk founded the Herald of Truth. And so, in a way, all of our Mennonite publishing that you could think of today, if you think of Lamp and Light or Rod and Staff or Christian Light, all of these things, all of it goes to this heritage of English language publishing begun by John F. Funk, or significantly begun in the United States anyway, by John F. Funk in the Civil War. And this received support from scattered Mennonites, because Mennonites at the time were scattering across the frontier with less fellowship than the more structured older communities in the East, in eastern Pennsylvania and Washington County, Maryland, etc. And so Herald of Truth was a way of keeping those people in the Mennonite fold who might otherwise have drifted away. So in conclusion, I want to tell you briefly the story of Father William Corby, a Roman Catholic chaplain in the Union Army for the Irish Brigade. And on the second day of Gettysburg, he said Mass and served communion to the Irish Brigade soldiers just before they went off to fight. And at the end of Mass, he raised his hands and he said, "The Catholic Church refuses Christian burial to any soldier who deserts his flag or turns his back to the foe." Now, in contrast to other churches which gave full-throated support to the cause of killing in the Civil War, Mennonites, in spite of their sometimes imperfect way of doing it, did find a way to apply and stay by and stay faithful to their non-resistant convictions and to the teachings of Jesus, to love your enemy, to resist not an evil man. Their faithfulness and the results of it and their experiences in the Civil War prepared Mennonites for a more faithful and uncompromising stand in the next war, in World War I. Thank you very much for your attention. I'd be glad to answer a few questions if anybody has any. I'm worried about what I didn't catch. Okay, over the southern states, you're saying. I think that could be a cynical way of looking at it. There was no constitutional right to secede. It was an illegal rebellion. And so Abraham Lincoln, you remember, was a lawyer. And so he's looking at this from a lawyer's perspective. There was no legal way to leave the country like that. And so he was like, "You're just leaving because I was elected. I was legally and fairly elected president, and so it's my job as president to enforce the laws, and this is the law. I'm going to enforce it." It has been the Civil War has been called the least avoidable conflict in history. It had such a long prehistory of violent clashing between pro-slavery and anti-slavery partisans that if somehow the conflict could have been avoided in the 1860s, the Civil War would have been fought in the 1870s. It's an unfortunate reality, but, you know, sin produces more sin. The sin of slavery produced the sin of the Civil War. Yeah, good question. I think the, if I'm remembering right, I don't have these statistics in front of me, but a an average income at the time would have been $1,000 in a year. So you're talking 30%. So if you think of your income, what 30% would be, that's about how much you'd have to pay for a commutation. Maybe I should ask for a raise of hands, but I'm not going to do that. I think I like to think that I would have helped. I don't see a scriptural reason why not to, and I see a scriptural reason to help those who are unfairly oppressed. I like to think that I would have helped. I hope I actually had the, would have had the courage. Well, you know, it, since it was illegal, it was probably something that they didn't talk about. If you were involved, you knew to, because the, like it said, there was very stiff penalties for breaking the Fugitive Slave Act. So if you were involved with it, you didn't say anything. And that's a problem for historians today studying the Underground Railroad. After the war, it was popular to say, hey, I helped in the Underground Railroad. And, you know, everybody's like, wants to be the hero, sort of like after World War II. Oh, yeah, I helped Jews, you know. Did they really? We know Peter Nisley did because he did something that was probably not smart but is great for historians. He kept a diary of the number of fugitives he helped. If he had been found out and that diary would have been found, he would have been a ruined man because he helped a lot of fugitives. And I held that diary in my hand at the Lancaster Mennonite Historical Library in Lancaster, Pennsylvania. It is just an amazing experience. That's one of the great things about being a historian is you get experiences like that. Yes. It was economic. The economy was a farming economy and was based mostly on cotton, and the cotton was harvested, planted, cared for by slave labor. So yeah, it was definitely economic. But over time, the South had come to see it as a way of life and to really buy into the white supremacy that, you know, these black people are barely even human. And, you know, there was a range of views. Some had kind of a paternalistic, like Robert E. Lee or Stonewall Jackson had this paternalistic, you know, we need, they're kind of like children, we need to take care of them, to where you had just people with horrendously racist attitudes of that slaves were, black people were not even human. Okay, thank you very much. I'll take one more.
Mm-hmm.
Sure. So not in the north. So that you would have been ridiculed by neighbors and there would have been opposition from that perspective. And especially Mennonites, I think, opened themselves up to it by voting. And they voted Republican and then not participating in the war. And so there was a lot of ridicule that came their way because of that, saying basically, you're inconsistent. You voted for this administration that's an anti-slavery administration, and now you're not participating in the war. So I think they kind of opened themselves up for that one. But in the South, yes, there was imprisonment. There was more direct persecution coming from the government, both the Virginia state government and the Confederate government, trying to force them into participation until there came to be exemption in the South as well. All right. Thanks very much. Glad to continue answering questions after the service.